Welcome to The Real Market with Chris Rising, the only podcast that brings the real estate conference panel to your headphones. You'll hear from superstars from every realm of commercial real estate, the biggest brokers, the most well-known architects, the largest investors, and the most visionary developers. We'll learn what they do, how they do it, and what drives their success. We'll discuss the latest trends across regional markets, capital flows, both national and global, and we'll explore technology's role in shaping all of them. We'll take a clear-eyed look at where we've been, where we are now, and what's to come. Real conversations, real experts, real insights. This is The Real Market.
Welcome to The Real Market with Chris Rising. I'm very excited today to have Neil Bawa with me today, who has a company called Grow Capitus. He is, I will tell you, of all the people I've interviewed on my podcast, from VC people to lawyers to brokers, you are the first, Neil, who self-identifies as a technologist first before you say you're a real estate guy. I think that's pretty cool and pretty interesting. And I'm really pleased that I could get you to come on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited to be on the podcast. And yes, I say to people, I am a geek, a dork, a nerd, whichever one catches your fancy, because some of the things that I'm going to say today are very, very nerdy, extremely nerdy, but they make an insane amount of money.
Well, you know, what'll be interesting as we go through this, I know you've got your 10 items of the forecast for the future that I want to go through that in some detail. But one of the battles that I see going on amongst my colleagues in the real estate industry is that just where does data, especially from an acquisition standpoint, play in someone's acquisitions process? I think traditionally, you know, it's easy to say comps are very important. I mean, you just look at the things that go into an appraisal and that kind of data is important. But I think you've taken it to a whole nother level. So as we start through this conversation, why don't we start how a self-described nerd or geek technologist has been so successful, and how did you get into real estate?
Sure. So, you know, my friends, and when I'm at, you know, at conferences, I get called to a lot of conferences because they want to have a nerd at every conference because they want to be seen as the data-driven conference, right? So my role is to kind of go up there and talk about data. And so my nickname, which I really like, I think it's very representative of me, is the mad scientist of multifamily, right? Mm-hmm. And so I am obsessed with the idea of using data science to create real estate profits, right? So I'm actually not interested in data science for the sake of science. I'm interested in how do I correlate numbers to maximization of profit for the least amount of work done, right? So my two x-axis and y-axis are, I want to do the least amount of work and I want to have the most amount of profit. And I want to track the heck out of it so that when I'm not successful, I can come back and say, I tried this experiment and it failed, but this one succeeded, because I've done both. I've had failed experiments and successful experiments. So the goal is continuously to be tracking. To go back to your question, there's always this discussion about how much data should people really be using when they're investing in real estate, because people are making profit and everyone believes that they're data driven. And the truth is, most people that are doing multifamily acquisition are, in fact, data-driven, because you're doing performance, you're doing underwriting, you're looking at rents, you're looking at expense ratios. There's a lot of data that is actually going into determining your offer price. So in that sense, all of you are data-driven. What I do, though, is I'm not saying I'm data-driven. I'm saying I'm a data scientist. What I'm saying is, when I look at what Christopher is doing and what 100 other people are doing, how do I do what they do? Maybe there's room to improve it slightly, but to be honest, it's not a huge difference, right? And then I say, what can I put on top of this? What can I do on top of this that accelerates profits that I don't see people doing? Because the key thing about data science, whether you are applying it to technology or to real estate or to banking, is you want to have access to data that other people don't have access to, or they have access to it 6 months or 12 months after you, mm-hmm. right? In which case, you know, you're first to it, so obviously you get a big benefit. So my interest as a data scientist is really not in improving what Christopher's doing and what a bunch of other people are doing. My interest is in adding to it. right? Mm-hmm. And when I add to it, I can add to it in two different ways, right? Three different ways, sorry. Number one is, what are the bigger long-term trends in the economy that people are not looking at? Because, you know, people are looking at, oh, here's a nice property. It's in Tucson. Tucson's doing well, blah, 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 you know, and the numbers work. So I'm going to make X offer. That's very common. That's how math is done. My question is, over the next 5 years, what are the trends affecting all of real estate in all of the US? How do I take those trends and tie them back to Tucson, right? What, is there an actual way of doing that? So that is trend-based data science. And the second data science is city-based data science. A lot of people are like, hey, I'm investing in Phoenix. I've made money in Phoenix on 6 consecutive properties. Therefore, Phoenix is a great market. And I completely agree with everything that you just said. But data scientists are not obsessed with finding great markets. They're obsessed with finding the greatest markets. And there's a big difference between those, right? So I'm obsessed with what is the greatest market? And data science tells us there is no greatest market. It's simply a stupid thing to say that, but there's always a greatest market today. And tomorrow it'll be some other market. Therefore,
let me just interrupt real quickly because all of these things sound like our investment committee meetings, these big macro trends. And how do you pick that overall market? But at the end of the day, a real estate project, a real estate asset is not a stock. It is not a widget. It is something that once owned also then has to be managed. And depending on what you're buying, a value add or a core. I mean, I hear everything you're saying, and then I go to, well, then once you own it, that's when you really create the value.
No, you don't. And I'm going to actually give you examples of the use of data science in managing an asset. Okay. And you will never, I guarantee if you've ever heard it, you've only heard it from me in other podcasts. So I'll give you examples of how you can use data science to improve the asset after you've purchased it, right? But for the moment, Chris, and I love this conversation, by the way, I'm glad you interrupted me because this it gets better that way. For the moment, assume that the asset that you and I are buying is the same asset. So we're actually, you know, and our underwriting is identical. So we are both basically saying this asset is worth $23.3 million. We're both, you know, bidding the exact same price based on the quality of the asset and the quality of the neighborhood. So with me so far?
Yep.
But I will often go and pay $500,000 more for that asset than you will, because I am using long-term trends where I'm actually mapping the benefit of those trends in cities that are ahead of Tucson in this made up examples of ours, because cities in the US are in cycles and some cities are 2 or sometimes even 3 years behind in the cycle. So if I'm tracking what the impact of a particular long-term trend is on other cities that are 3 years ahead, I also know which cities are ahead in the cycle or not because data science tells you that, then I can actually pay more than you and buy more properties than you can and still create more profit because I'm, you know, using the long-term trending. And I would argue that the syndication community is pretty awesome at pro forma development when it comes to individual properties and understanding the value of the property. I would tell you, I completely would disagree with anyone that says that they're good in tracking trends. They are not. They are not. 90% of syndication companies focus on one or two metros. There is no way to combine long-term trending, either at the trend level or the city level, with a syndicator that invests in two markets. Because what you're saying is, I'm in great markets and I don't care about the greatest markets. So I think that from a pro forma perspective, the industry does really, really well and is very data-driven. At an individual property level. But once we start looking at the back off at you know, a city level or a trend level is national, city level is, you know, at the city level. I am not seeing the proper use of data science as I define it as a data scientist.
Well, just to give a little context, Grow Capitis has about 3,000 units. You are mostly, as we were talking before, in red states, maybe a purple state here or there. You are based in the Silicon Valley, San Francisco area, but yet you're buying things, which I have to imagine on a day-to-day basis, you're not living in those markets. And, you know, that's one of the things that syndicators love to say, well, I know every block on every street, you know, and every little niche of these submarkets, and that's why I'm good at it. So as you sit where you sit and look out, how are you getting the data that even tells you, are you just going to Google and plugging in Tucson and saying, let me see what reports, or what are you doing that allows you to invest in these markets but not be in them day to day physically?
I became obsessed with this concept of, and this is a while back, you know, I created the system about 6 or 7 years ago, because I realized that I was vulnerable as a data scientist, because data will tell me a lot about a city. It'll tell me, but what about the neighborhood? You know, people say this side of the tracks is better than that side. This side of the road is better than that side. And they're right. They're absolutely right. In fact, it's a huge difference. Often one side of a road, you can see the property, it's on the other side, but that side of the road is $200,000 less per unit, right? Compared to this side, because that's how we define neighborhoods in the US. So how do I, without actually physically being in a city, know it? And not just know it, I wanted to know it better than the agent that's been working that neighborhood for 20 years. I wanted to know it better than them, right? And the answer is data science allows you to do that. In fact, I use a software where I overlay trends such as, you know, income increases, home price increases, poverty reduction on a neighborhood level. And the beautiful thing is the data actually, if you use color, shows you where each neighborhood starts and ends. So I have the ability to randomly pick a city. So Christopher can give me a city. You know, Christopher says, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, right? I can actually sit down with Christopher, overlay data on top of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and tell you where the neighborhoods are starting and ending, and where does the affluent neighborhood end. I can say things like, if you go to the other side of this road, you know, you're going to go up 50,000 a unit or 50 down 50,000 a unit. So data does allow you to do that in a way that is actually better than some of the people that, you know, that live there. Having said that, I always, always, always send people there, because you can't make, you know about things such as there's a porn store, you know, right next to this property, yeah, or there's, you know, women standing at 10 o'clock at the corner. Those are necessary. There's nothing that data science can do to overcome those things.
Google Earth doesn't do that for you.
Well, 2 years out of date, right?
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Is this your proprietary IP that you're discussing, the software, or is this someone off the shelf kind of software?
So I'm very obsessed with being the Wikipedia of data science. I cannot be Wikipedia and have proprietary technology. So every time I come up with a concept, I create a course. One of the courses is on udemy.com. So it's, you know, there's 10,000 people right now taking the course. You can just type in Neil Bawa space Udemy and you'll see there's 10,000 people taking it. There's 1,000 five-star reviews. And so whenever I come up with a new version of it, I'll update it. The only thing I'm careful about doing is this. I try and get the public stuff that I give away to about 90% accuracy compared to the private stuff that I do, which probably has 20 or 50 other metrics. What I find is if I make it too complicated for people, they just won't do it. So I'm obsessed with this concept of when I'm giving technology and data science away to people, they should be able to evaluate with less than 30 minutes of work. So I'll give them the simplest system that works in a 30-minute time frame. So maybe they're evaluating a city or a region or a state. I don't want them to spend more than 30 minutes because I've noticed people don't do it, right?
Yeah.
Internally, my team adds on a lot of macro metrics, and some of those are available as paid data. So we're paying, you know, for different services. I think we have 5 or 6 services that we pay for. But I'm delighted to let you know that more than 90% of the time, the free course that we give away on udemy.com and the updated version is on a website called multifamilyu.com, which is Multifamily University. I'm first and always a teacher, right? So to me, what comes most naturally is teaching things to people, because I came from a family of teachers. Dad was a teacher, mom was a teacher, mother-in-law, father-in-law, sister-in-law, all teachers, right? So to me, I think that gives me the most amount of joy to share this with other people. And you might say, how is it that you share this with people? What's the benefit you get out of it? The benefit that I receive is massively greater than charging for this. Very simple reason. I'm one of maybe 4 syndicators in the US that can raise a market because I have 50,000 people following me. When I see the data, I will go out and buy my land first. I'll go out and put properties in contract first, and then I'll publish the data. So it's often is 60 days out of date, which is still extremely current data.
You've just hit on about five things that I want to break down and go through. But the first is, you know, when the Jobs Act happened in 2012, what a lot of people didn't pay attention to early on was the fact that when I started in this business, if you wanted to go raise money, I mean, you had to have numbered PPMs, private placement memorandums. You send something out for a deal. Those people who didn't invest had to send it back to you. And then in 2012, that all changed, and you can try to attract accredited investors through some sort of advertising and things like that. Mm-hmm. Our company has moved its platform, what used to be, you know, friends and family, all to a digital platform. You've done that. Yep. I have a few friends out there you may know. Chris Powers from Fort Capital does that, and mm-hmm. Keith Wasserman does that at Gilt. But it's still a relatively small group of people who are building their own, I would say, platform of investors, not doing it like Realty Mogul or CrowdStreet or Fundrise, but proprietary. Let me ask you, I guess a long-winded setup to, did you start with three people or five people when you made your first acquisition, or did you take this mentality, get it out there, and you were able to syndicate on a bigger basis? I'm just trying to get to your origin story on your first deal or two.
Sure. So I'll give you the answer to it, and then I'll give you the background, right? So I believed, you know, I came from selling a technology company before I got started with real estate as a professional. I've been playing with real estate for a long time for my personal gains, but as a professional taking other people's money, I was already rich. I was a technology professional, owned a piece of a company that I sold. I came from this background that's very rare. Most syndicators start their business by investing their time, and usually they take on a partner or two, and the investment that you're making is your time. I've always believed that that's not enough if you want to make a truly successful company, right? Because my initial goal, which I've already reached, was I wanted $1 billion of real estate at the same time, assets under management, 1 billion. And I realized it would take me too long to get there through generic growth. So I came from the belief that you actually shouldn't just be investing your time when you start a syndication company. You have to invest your money. So I took $250,000 out of my technology company profit, and I basically started building scaled digital systems. And I hired experts who are growth hackers from the San Francisco Bay Area market. San Francisco Bay Area has the most number of growth hackers. A growth hacker is a term for a marketing director that is just focused on hacking the system, whatever system they're targeting, to create 5x or 10x annual growth, where most marketeers are looking at a 30% annual growth. A growth hacker's job is you go up 10x, then you go up another 10x, right? So it's a completely different kind of marketing director. And so at the same time, when I started the company, I used that money to hire two completely different marketing departments. So they've stayed separate. So I have a growth hacking department of four people and a marketing department of four people. And so very early on, I made that investment because I wanted that extraordinary rapid growth. But having said that, yes, I started like everybody else with four or five people. I just made very, very rapid investments of money, injected a significant amount of money. And then eventually one day I took that money out as you know, the fees started to come in. But I made that investment, and I think that was the difference, because my growth curve in the industry is much faster than anyone else's, right? So I tripled, for example, the amount of equity I raised in the last 12 months. In the last 12 months, as of last week, I've raised $120 million. Most people in the industry, even the superstars, do not raise $120 million in a year. There are some, but they're cheating because they raise it through large checks from institutionals. I've raised $120 million in the last 12 months. And I think the biggest check was $1 million, and it was just a regular retail investor. But when I look at my average, it's still, you know, a couple hundred thousand. So it's not, you know, so it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of investors through a massive marketing machine, which is based on data science. So I'm a nerd, and my investors are nerds too.
What you said is based on data science. So I take it this is hardly one person writing five emails, and that's how it goes. You must have a very sophisticated process, and I assume it relies on at least bots, if not stronger AI. Or what are you doing in that marketing that you think is probably different than 99% of the syndicators out there?
Lots of different things. So I'll give you some examples, but there are, understand that I'm giving you maybe 1%, right? So one of the things that I looked at very early on is everyone is obsessed with finding accredited investors. I had no interest from the very beginning in non-accredited investors. I realized that to scale, you had to go to investors that not only had money, but had enough money to keep giving me money 6 or 7 or 8 times in a year, which non-accredited investors don't do. They give you $25,000 once and they back off for a couple of years, right? I wanted somebody that could give me $1 million a year in 6 different projects. And I came to the realization it had to be accredited investors. Now, everyone basically says, okay, we're going to go after accredited investors. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. But I realized you have to basically build a technology system. So what we did was we first looked for lists of accredited investors. When we found them on the web, they're horrible. They're absolutely terrible. Most syndicators have bought them and wasted humongous amounts of money. So I set up my growth hacking director. I set up his department to buy those lists, and they're tens of thousands of dollars, to buy those lists, millions of people, but only 20% of the list is actually accurate. You know that the good people are in there, but they're mostly bad people in there, right? Because otherwise the lists would cost millions of dollars. They wouldn't cost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. So we created a system where we purchased 6 or 7 different software subscriptions, and then we moved those lists through these 6 or 7 different software, cleaning them up until we ended up with just the exact accredited investors, right? And so we cleaned the rest of the list out, threw it away. We had no interest in it. Found those 20%. And once we had those 20%, we started targeting those people using platforms like Facebook and LinkedIn.
What would be those softwares that you used as a filter? You said you had 5 or 6 software filters to get to a final list.
The truth is, these software change every 6 months. And the growth hacking director, who you're welcome to bring onto your program, we don't hide this stuff, by the way. We'll be happy to give it to you. I'm going to give it to you later in the program because I'm going to think about this in the back of my mind on what the most recent
software. Just going, is that just something you found going through a Google search and things like that? Or is that
No. That's a very elaborate setup because you use a software called Zapier. Zapier.
Yeah, we use it.
And you connect 6 or 7 different cleaning software together, and you push each record through at a time, pushing somewhere between 50,000 and 100,000 records a month, right? And that's going to cost you about maybe $5,000 to $10,000 a month to kind of clean that data, right? Because what you really want, and by the way, at the end of this time, when you had that 1 million person list, now you're down to 200,000. It's not like you can directly use them. So people think that if I had a list of 200,000 true accredited investors, I could just send them emails. The answer is it's completely worthless. You will not generate one dime from those people, right? You have to find a way to attract rich people in a way that they don't think they're being advertised to, right? And the answer to that is Facebook. So we spent a year building a true list, and then we spent 2 years following these 200,000 people around the web. That's a very elaborate process. But if someone is truly interested and you spend a few weeks immersed into how Facebook works, you can find it. It's called custom audiences, right? The Facebook, if you advertise to them, they will show your ad to a bunch of people that will never be accredited, that will never buy a syndication. They're not interested in real estate. So your Facebook cost is 100 times higher than you can afford. But what if you told Facebook the audience?
Yeah. Yeah, we are in a similar area doing some of these similar things. But what I'm amazed by, and I'd love to get your thought on this, is I personally don't use Facebook very often. I mean, I'm on it, and it was something that I was more engaged with years ago. My kids, my 17-year-olds, certainly don't have an interest in it. Yet over and over again, the best success we've had is our advertising through Facebook. So what is it about Facebook and the kind of accredited investors in your mind that allows people to raise money from Facebook?
So and this will change in 5 years. It'll be a different software 10 years from now because of what you just mentioned. Facebook's losing brand value with younger people, right? And to some extent, it's losing brand value with older people as well. It's this in-between group of, you know, 35 to 55 year olds where there's still enough engagement. The answer is Facebook has the best data. You know, Facebook gives all this stuff away for free. Like, for example, WhatsApp is free. Have you ever paid for WhatsApp? No, but there's tens of millions of people or hundreds of millions of people using Facebook, WhatsApp. Why don't they charge $1 a month or $1 a year for it? Well, that's because they're only interested in watching what you're doing on WhatsApp, right? So they're taking every single data stream there and they're turning it into interest lists. So the reason why Facebook's more successful is they're truly a company that creates value through snooping on people and looking at what it is that you're doing and categorizing you. We still use their technology to filter, but first we provide pre-filtered lists. And I think the minimum list we provide is 200,000 people.
Wow. What do you think of other places like LinkedIn or Instagram or Twitter? I mean, who knows what may be happening today with Twitter, Elon Musk, but what do you think of those venues?
So obviously with a 14-person marketing team, we are currently on Insta, on Twitter. We're on all of these platforms that you just mentioned. But what I'm finding is that when it comes to platforms, you can't focus on six or seven of them. So what we've done is we focus on one or two platforms that really work for us, and they generate 70 or 80% of our incoming referrals. And then we have the rest. And what we do is we create a system where we're creating our content for the two platforms that we like. And then we create a secondary system where that content is taken and broken up into uses on Insta or Twitter. But we never actually spend any brain power on those other platforms. So they're still being maintained. If you go to my Twitter account, I don't use Facebook or Twitter. So if you're seeing me post 60 times a week on Twitter or Facebook, it's not me, right? There's other people posting on there, right? I don't even actually have my Facebook login. Every time I need it, I have to go and ask a bunch of people. The bottom line, though, is that if you know which of these work, right? So the obsession with data science is about tracking everything. So I'll give you an example of this, right? So I believe we are the only syndicator in the US that has 3 million tags in our database. A tag is me looking at what Christopher Rising is doing and saying, Christopher, I see you're interested in this kind of syndication, but you're not interested in that kind. I see you're interested in my banking webinar, but you're not interested in my interest rate webinar, right? I'm basically profiling everything that you're doing once you're in my database, and I'm tagging you. So there are investors in my database that have been in there for 5 years. I might have 1,000 tags about them. And then I have a bunch of people that say, okay, now we're going to take these tags and segment or slice up the database so that not everyone gets the same advertisements, not everyone gets the same email, and not everyone gets the same pitch. So we've created slices of our database of people that respond to certain kinds of pitches. Is it a fear-based pitch? Is it a greed-based pitch, right? Is it based on long-term growth? Is it based on fear of taxes? What attracts Christopher the most, right? And then I'm going to customize all of my messaging so that Christopher gets it. And then you might say, oh my God, that's a lot of work. No, it isn't. The way technology is, it makes it simple. Because what we do is we create something known as a segment. So if I'm sending a message to Christopher that's 3 pages long, only one paragraph changes. But that paragraph is always at the top. And it addresses Christopher's greed, his fear, his interest, right? Mm-hmm. Only that one paragraph is different. Everything else is the same in the marketing. And so as we use tags, different people tag differently are getting that one paragraph different because that's what catches their attention, the fear, the greed, the interest. And then the rest of it is the same.
Is there some AI that's tagging it, or is it really people in your marketing department who are like, well, I could tell. How do the tags get performed?
So the answer is nobody is actually physically tagging people. As you can imagine, that would be too hard. What we are doing is working on something known as automation. So whether you're using Salesforce or ActiveCampaign, you're using a software, you're using a feature called automations. And this automations feature, the way that it works, regardless of which software you use, the way that all of them work is they give a ranking to a certain action. So if Christopher clicks on a certain page on my website and then clicks on another page within it and another page, well, every click has a certain score and a certain tag. Overall, if Christopher engages more with us, his score goes up, right? And then his tags keep getting added in. And over time, because the tags, when we create the tags manually, we don't add them manually to Christopher's account, but we do create them. We put them in a certain umbrella. So an umbrella might be very interested in taxation impact, or another umbrella might be extremely paranoid about interest rates and how they affect, you know, real estate. So because the tags are in buckets, and all of the tags are pointed back to clicks, action that Christopher takes in email or in on our website or during our webinar, all of the rest is happening through automations. And we have hundreds, if not thousands, of automations running.
One of the things
we're a technology company, right? I'm not a real estate guy. I'm just a technologist that is trying to basically use technology to hack everything. And that's why I have an army in the Philippines, right? I have a massive, you know, office in the Philippines, and 2/3 of my company is Filipino. So if I hire one person in the US, I open 2 requisitions in the Philippines. And they have their own managers, they have their own directors, they have their own recruiting departments. They do all of that stuff in the Philippines. And so by attaching those 2 people to this one person, I triple my gain for each employee.
And interesting. So let me ask you a couple of just questions that I know my audience sometimes asks about is, so did you say you use Salesforce or do you use HubSpot, or what are some of the backbone technologies that are allowing you to do it that sound like they're off the shelf, whether it's Salesforce or HubSpot?
Salesforce is the best sales-based CRM product in the world. So if you have large sales teams, which I don't, you should use Salesforce. That's what they tend to focus on the most, right? The managing the effort of hundreds or thousands of salespeople, Salesforce will do the best job in the world. HubSpot is a marketing automation product. It's the best in the world at marketing-driven companies that have very small sales forces. Almost all the messaging is going out in an automated fashion. ActiveCampaign is something in the middle. And if you look at the names, they're very interesting. They tell you a lot, right? ActiveCampaign is not as powerful as HubSpot, but it's for people like me that want to actively track my customers. ActiveCampaign. So it is the world's best CRM for automations-driven marketing, right? So it's in the middle. It's in the middle. HubSpot is much more powerful, but its automation capability is nowhere near ActiveCampaign.
Now, when you deal with your investors, do you use something like Juniper Square or IMS, or how does that integrate into anything you're doing? That kind of security with the money that comes in and out and reporting to investors.
We use a tool called IDR, so Investor Deal Room. And what I like to do is, as a technology pioneer in a company filled with technologists and software people, is that I like to be the alpha customer for a new company. So when IDR was just basically 2 guys writing code, I went to them and I said, I want a locked-in price for 3 years. I will become your alpha customer. You can't get somebody with a $800 million, record like me. I'm also very well known at conferences, because this is a question I get asked a lot, right? You'd be surprised how often people ask me this question. And so I felt like there was brand value. They agreed with me. So we basically said, we will be on your advisory board. And when we need features, you're going to do your best effort to write those features in, right? And they've now written dozens of features into the software, including its support of something known as Zapier. Zapier is basically an incredible tool that allows different software to talk to each other without programming. And so we kept pushing them until they basically built Zapier into the platform. So the answer is, our tool, IDR, is fully integrated with ActiveCampaign, but through Zapier. That way, we're not messing with IDR too much. We're simply defining, okay, this person in ActiveCampaign, it's this contact record in the IDR. That's what that relationship is being defined through Zapier.
We use Zapier a lot too. We do find it has its limitations.
At some point, it does.
My tasks in HubSpot are going to work with my task at Asana, and Zapier haven't figured that out yet. But anyway, that's my own personal frustration.
Asana, by the way, is a third piece because you neither one of the two software you just mentioned does project management. So for us, Asana is the center of all of this stuff, because I do not, for example, in our company, email is banned inside the company unless it's for specific purposes, right? So
everything,
right? Yep. So there's two places where you can talk to other people inside the company. One is Slack, which is our communication software. So you have to talk in Slack channels for specific projects, right? Or specific departments. And the second is, if you're sending an email, fine, you can send an email, but you must send it to Asana. You can't send email to people. You have to send it to Asana, and then Asana takes actions based on that and creates tasks. So by doing that, we've managed to even integrate IDR and ActiveCampaign with Asana through email, right? Yep. So that greatly speeds things up.
We do the same.
By the way, this is a wonderful geeky conversation. I usually don't get into it in podcasts.
Well, what I love is that I met Dustin in 2012 up on I was up on summit outside on a mountain in Utah, and I started talking to him about how much I loved his product Asana, and I said, but you know, it gets frustrating because you know you do like five things great and then nothing, and he goes, you just watch. This is almost 10 years ago. He was saying, we listen so well to our customers. You'll start to get frustrated. We'll hear people frustrated, and then we'll have an update and it'll fix it. And it's been very true, the way that software has grown. We actually have internally our own interactive PDF on how to use Asana within our company. And rule number one, you never email each other internally. You just never do it. I get it that you're going to be emails to people in the outside world. But if there's going to be something internal, it has to be a task. And I love the way Asana has moved in goals, and it keeps getting there. But we've talked a lot about all this stuff, but I want to give you the chance to say, okay, you do all this stuff. How successful? How many investors do you think that you can reliably count on to invest in deals do you have on your platform?
So I'll give you that number, but I'm not obsessed with how many investors I have. That's just a byproduct. I'm interested in speed of growth. So my primary target is doubling to tripling my investor database each year. And I have three different levels of those. One is that multi-million database that I call the shadow database. Okay, shadow database, which is basically everyone in the universe that I think I want to attract. Right? It's the cleaned up version of these crappy lists that you buy on the web, right? So it's called a shadow database. And then the second piece of it is people that are highly engaged with me. They have very high engagement scores. They haven't given me money yet. And there's 58,000 of those people. And then there's the people that have given me money. And, you know, it's not easy to give me money because I keep raising my minimum. So in the last 4 years, my minimum has been 100,000. And now I've raised it to 250,000. Right. So it's harder and harder to be in that list because I keep raising that amount. And so that's 800. So I've got 800 investors. But what I'm not interested in that 800 number. It's just, it makes you feel good. What I'm interested in is how fast am I growing in every quarter from the previous list of investors? How fast am I growing that 58,000 list? What's the delta every quarter and every year? All of my marketing teams are compensated based on delta. Right? How much is that million person list growing by? So I'm really more focused on what that number is. The last year, I set a goal of 2.5x for the investors and the database. On the database side, we didn't quite make it, but on the investor side, we actually went beyond. So we were at 3x in terms of that count.
So we're talking a lot about syndication and building your list. One of my great frustrations is I find real estate can often be very linear. Because it's so complicated to find a deal, to go through a best and final or convince an off-market seller, and then to close the deal. How do you deal with that issue? We talk about it all the time. I have a meeting later today to say, I want us to stop thinking so linearly on our top 10 list and get to more exponential. We can be buying 3, 5, 10 properties in a quarter instead of just trying to get, you know, 1 to 3 closed in a quarter. How do you deal with that issue?
Two different approaches. Number one, if the market won't give me all the product that I want, if the market is so restricted that I can't really grow in a nonlinear fashion, I will create my own product. So 70% of my product is new construction. 30% is what everybody loves, value add. You never stop value add, right? It's awesome. Yeah. So 70% of my product is product that I created so that other people may buy it. If I am convinced that a certain market or a certain corridor in the US will have shortages for the next 3 to 5 years, then I go and create that product in there myself, right? So I basically end up being on the seller side of the equation instead of the buyer side of the equation, right? One way to fix the problem. It doesn't work all the time, by the way, right?
But let's break that down because I don't know if I understand what you're saying. Are you saying you're buying land and then selling the land, or you're buying land and you're building something? Or
no, I'm a full stack developer. I have an army of people that work for me. all the way from zoning and permitting to city approvals to going vertical. So all of these people are inside of the company. And basically, because I've had this frustration as long as you've had it, I just simply said, if the market won't permit me to grow at the speed that I want, I will basically create my own product.
Yeah.
Right. And so, no, I go all the way from buying the land, then going through that zoning process, yelling at the city, being beaten up by neighbors, going through that process, zoning the land, and then basically improving the land on the horizontal side and then going vertical on it. And then at the end of that process, either I hold the property or I sell it. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's one way. The second question, I think, is one that you're going to be more interested in. So I looked at this and I said, okay, well, the big cities, I mean, I am like you, I'm very focused on, you know, underwriting needs to work. And clearly when I focus on underwriting needs to work, I'm not buying enough properties, right? You've had the same problem. So the question is, there must be a solution out of that. And the solution is move down from that market to the next tier market where the underwriting works. And now that has always been a bad thing. It's a bad thing to say in our industry because people are very tied to this concept of the primary and secondary markets are safer, right? Mm-hmm. And the truth is this. If I look at the data for older recessions, older US recessions, it's always been true. So if you look at recessions in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and even the 90s, the tertiary markets got hit a lot harder than the primary markets. But here's the problem. When you look at data, the most dangerous thing you can do is look at incomplete data, right? You might better not to look at it at all. So what most people know in the syndication industry is tertiary markets got hit harder during recessions than primaries and secondaries, and they're right. The question that they should be asking, though, is over a five-year time frame, before recession, during recession, and after recession, if you held the tertiary property, which one created more profits? The answer is over 95% of the time, the tertiary market created more profits. So you always need to hold a tertiary product through a recession, suffer, because you're going to suffer. But when you finish the suffering, you're going to beat the returns of the secondary and primary markets. Now, post-COVID, obviously, that's not even true anymore because the tertiaries are actually seeing massive, massive population growth, right? Incredible, like Idaho Falls, Logan, Utah, Dalton, Georgia. These are places nobody's heard of. They're seeing enormous growth. But pre-COVID, those markets were more profitable.
Well, I really want to get into your 10 trends, but before we jump into that, you sound like a man who is quite driven for excellence in what you do. You have built something from scratch that I think is admirable and something that I know my listeners are all going to be like, Chris, you should have had a Neil on much, much sooner. But how do you do all that and with technology dominating so much of your life and have a life and be a husband and do your life? How do you live in this world that seems very focused on constantly producing?
So I think that my greatest achievement in the last 5 years has been that I have a very balanced life, right? And I know that word gets overused a lot, but I truly can say that for myself. So for example, if you look at the last 10 days, I've been on vacation in Santa Ana, Miami, and Breckenridge, Denver, right? So I've come back from a 10-day vacation, and I'm going on a 30-day vacation to two European cities and an African city, Morocco, London and Paris in early June, as soon as my kids are done. I obsess over this as much as I obsess over everything else. So my greatest obsession was, how can I build a company that doubles or triples in size when I'm only working 30 hours a week at most? I do not want to go over 30 hours a week. And there's weeks I go over, but you know, an average. And the answer was systems, empowering employees, and an army in the Philippines. I think all of these were needed. But I work the least of anybody, any of my contemporaries in the industry, because I've created amazing systems where people do the work for me. Whether those are technology-driven systems, whether those are employee-driven systems, compensation-driven systems, I've made 7-8 people partners in my projects based on the performance of those. And I change those performance criteria all the time, which my partners hate, by the way. But I change them all the time because there's no way to keep them constant, right? You're either over or under compensating people. So I do that, but I don't make them partners in my company. That logo in behind it, that I'm the only person that owns any shares in, right? But I make them partners in my projects. That way, the construction people are only partnered in the construction projects. And the value-add people are only partnered in their projects. So, you know, compensation is a very key driver of good behavior. So I'm focused on those. So what I hate doing is any kind of daily work. What I like doing is every day saying, what do I do today that reduces the burden on me? And if you ask that question and obsess over it every day, you end up with amazing, amazing systems. And I have staff, for example, there's four people in the Philippines that planned my 20th anniversary. There were people that, you know, figured out where we were going, and there are people who I created 20 gifts for my wife, and all of that was done basically by an army of people. So I don't believe you can ever have enough executive assistants. I have three, and they're all very, very busy. They're all working 55 hours a week, and I'm not.
Mm-hmm. That's terrific. Switching over to talking about the content. I think one of the keys that I heard earlier in our discussion was that you mentioned many, many different ways that you can connect with investors and potential investors through producing your own content. Can you talk a little bit about how you've created this community around yourself and Grow Capitus that is, I think, a pretty, it's outstanding. I mean, some of the stats that I saw in preparing for this, you've really created a community of real estate investors that are actively engaged with you. How have you done it? What are some of the keys to it?
Experimentation. I think I tried lots of different things. I tried writing long blogs. But what happens is that people write these long blogs and very proud of them because investors come up to you and say, hey, I read the blog. And so they think they should continue to move in that direction. Because I'm mostly interested in delta, in growth, I don't care if 100 people read my long blog and I got 5 investors out of it. My focus is I want to write the same amount of content the following year and get more people, right? So 100 this year is good. 100 next year is crap. It has to be 130 or 200 or 300. So when you have this growth-based mentality, which clearly comes out of Silicon Valley, you can tell, right? I'm very schooled in Silicon Valley thought, exponential growth, blah, blah, blah. It also comes from a math background. Yeah, as you can tell, I do math in my head constantly. So I'm looking for anything that looks like a linear curve, I absolutely hate. It has to have exponential curve capability. So I've experimented with maybe 15, 16 different channels, right? And what I found was, the greatest channel of all kind was not the one that gave you the most eyeballs. The greatest kind of channel was the one that gave you the most branding. So for example, you might think, why doesn't this guy have his own podcast? And my answer is, I do. It's called Everyone Else's Podcast. My data proved to me that when I go out and talk about my approach, which is systems and data and automation driven, people like that. So I never created my own podcast, right? Because I was finding exponential curves with Everyone Else's Podcast. But with other things, I found that the opposite was happening. So the amount of time that people are spending on podcasts, I'm spending that time. I'm not, you know, goofing off, but I'm spending that time creating the best content in the industry. And I found that that really worked well. So I hired a content team of 3 people. And every time I hear about something happening in the industry, right now, the hottest thing in the industry is this obscene increase in interest rates in the last 35 days, right? It's been shocking. It's the greatest in history. It's obviously going to affect us. It hasn't affected us yet. Well, it's affected the industry, but none of the investors are aware of what happened in the last 35, 40 days. They haven't figured it out yet, right? There's all the articles on my Flipboard are still about insane increases in home prices. Well, they're abruptly going to come to a stop in the next 60 days. Right. So I stay on top of the content using Flipboard by using thumb up, thumb down. Right. And then what happens is my team logs into Flipboard from a different computer and they're looking at what I'm constantly thumbing up and down. And they come back to me and say, should we do a webinar about this? Should we do content on this? So I often will do hour long deep dive webinars, and I do about 25 of them a year. They take an enormous amount of time to build because 100% of the content is custom. But the credibility that creates, with the people that show up is incredible. We've had 173,000 registrations for our in-house webinars, right? Wow. Which is by far the largest in the industry. I know that there's people out there that have had more people register for webinars, but a lot of those are, you know, just like webinars about investing. I get that. Yeah. That's useful.
Yeah, yeah.
My webinars have nothing to do with investing at all. They have everything to do with informing people about the world out there. I'm only interested in creating credibility in webinars. I pitch nothing. So it's just a brand process.
I love to, not many people know a Flipboard anymore, thanks to Apple News and the way Apple has constructed the iPad today, or the Google News has. But what is it about your going into Flipboard? That must mean you spend a lot of time reading and liking or not liking for your people to then decipher through it and say, should we do a webinar? I mean, do you count that as part of your 30 hours that you only want to work in a week, or is this your downtime rating?
It's two or three hours out of that 30 hours is doing this kind of research. The goal there is to not just inform them about what I'm interested in. The goal is for them to use all of those thumb ups as the content for the webinar, right? Yeah. So I'm building the content library for a webinar by thumbing it up. So if I thumb up 20 articles about increases in interest rates, then they know, okay, well, he's clearly very interested in interest rates right now. We should start building a webinar. But they also have 20 articles to take content from. So I'm building the webinar at the same time as showing my interest.
That's interesting. Well, I really want to get into the top disruptive trends. But right before we do, you've brought up the use of offshore workers and using the Philippines. Number one, what is it about the Philippines as opposed to, say, Costa Rica or India, or some of the other places that you've really liked? And secondly, what type of people are you hiring? Because I think a lot of people tend to only think of hiring offshore as hiring accountants. So, you know, why the Philippines and what are those employees really doing?
They're doing everything. The challenge is finding a way for the Filipinos to do everything, because if you mentally pigeonhole them, they're not going to be force multipliers. I'm very interested in how do I get two Filipinos to have at least the same productivity as an American employee. I've never tried to do a one-on-one. I think Americans are amazing with their productivity. It's a very advanced culture. It's a very technologically advanced culture. So I've never tried to make one Filipino as good as one American. I think that's a fool's errand. But I can make two Filipinos be better than one American simply because they have twice the number of hours. So the challenge has been, how do I get the Filipinos to do everything that an American does? And I haven't succeeded at that challenge, but I've succeeded with hundreds of things that most people would not consider to be something that you would do in the Philippines, right? So, for example, investor management is something that most people would say, no, don't introduce your Filipino folks to the investors. That's not true. We have spokes in the Philippines, their managers and directors, that train them on every word to say. And they're vastly superior to US-based investor relations manager. They're not direct selling, but they're sales support in hundreds of different ways. So to go back to why Philippines, right? So the first thing is, where's the talent pool? There's basically three large volume talent pools when it comes to outsourcing. One's Mexico, the second one is India, and the third one is the Philippines. You could say Ukraine, but there's just not enough Ukrainians. I mean, I want to have access to hundreds of thousands of people that already work nights. Already work nights and have worked nights for years, right? I do not want to teach somebody how to work at night because it's a very different thing from working during the day. So my talent pools are limited. The Mexicans don't work during the night because they're in our time zones, but otherwise that pool's available, right? So when I studied the three markets, overall the Filipinos came out ahead of the Indians. Number one, accent. Number two, ethics. Indians are also very ethical. And again, I'm typecasting, so I apologize to anyone that's listening. But I'm a data scientist. I will rank people for everything. And what I found was, in terms of pure ethics, the Indians were the strongest, then the Filipinos, then the Mexicans, in terms of stealing time. I'm not talking about stealing money. I'm talking about stealing time. right? So, and then, so I started ranking the different things. Then I ranked accents. Accents matter a lot because all of my Filipinos are on the phone and the Philippines is far ahead of everybody else. And what I also found was the Philippines is not ahead if I used men. So I only hire women because their voices are thinner. They're much easier to understand than Filipino men, right? So by ranking these, what I found was overall, there was, it would definitely made sense for the Philippines to be the base. You could say, why not Indians? The answer is build one base, hire a bunch of managers and directors that are constantly coaching and training and hiring and firing the people. Why build two bases? It's a very large country. The Philippines, I think, is a seventh or eighth largest country in the world. They love the kind of money that I can offer them. I pay more than anybody else does because I'm very obsessed with, I will train you. I will expect performance. I will monitor you in 32 different ways and you will work for me, you know, constantly at a very high productivity rate. And I will pay you more than anybody else ever can.
Wow. And how, and when you first got a foothold in the Philippines, how, did you approach a firm there that helped you? Did you get on an airplane and you went there and you met people? How did you do it?
All of the above, all failures. So I did the airplane thing to the Philippines. That was a total waste of my time. I did the hire from other companies, also a total waste of my time, because every time I would hire people from other companies, just as they got good, they took them away and replaced them with bad people. And now I ended up being the one that trained all of these people to make them good, only so that they could be moved to somebody else. So eventually I realized the only thing that works is to have my own team. So I use a website called Upwork. I use it much better than most people use it, because most people think Upwork is just a job engine. And it is. It obviously is a job engine to get through to the Filipinos. But if you Google Neil Bawa Virtual Assistants, I have 50-minute podcasts that show you 25 different things to turn on in Upwork, because I'm obsessed with what are the top 0.01% of Filipinos, right?
Wow.
And so those are all switches, software switches you can turn on the Upwork website. For example, most people think that 90% is a good ranking. It's not. 99% is the lowest acceptable ranking of quality on Upwork, 99. So most people, and there's no 99% button. The only button available is, you know, 50%, 70, 90, 80, and 90. So what you have to do is first you got to click on the 90 button. And then as you're looking through the list, you need to have a Filipino filter those people that manually say 99% acceptability ratio or ranking ratio, and then get rid of everybody else and make lists of people inside of Upwork so that we can start attacking people. Never go after people that are available, because usually the people that are available are not high in quality. So we only attack people that are already employed.
Wow. That is amazing. I mean, it's so far beyond what I know we've been doing and what I'm going to strive for our team to reach for. I should have known that I think I could be talking with you.
We can come back and do the trends again, or maybe we can do one of the trends.
No. Well, let's do the trends. There's another question that has been lingering in my head that I wanted to go back to as well, which is when you are looking at identifying markets and identifying an asset that you want to buy in a market. You mentioned there was four or five sources of data that you would go to. Now, I assume, and that's always a mistake to assume, but I assume that you're in the general way saying CoStar or some of the CoStar competitors out there that you're filtering data from, or did I totally miss that?
So I pay for CoStar just like you do, right? So let's get that out of the way. CoStar is amazing, right? Totally worth the money. I don't think that people starting in this industry or people trying to buy their own first single family rental will be buying CoStar. So my obsession when I got started with this had nothing to do with CoStar or multifamily. It had to do with simply, how do I rank cities in the US for real estate investment, whether that's single family or multifamily, right? So remember where I started from. It has nothing to do with syndication. I built this system 5 years before I became a real estate anybody. Right. So I would go to conferences. People would basically call me to conferences and I would come down the stage and people would say, how do I invest with you? And I would say, I'm running a technology company. You can't invest with me. everything I set up on stage was for my personal portfolio, and you can just take it and do whatever you want with it. And people would be like, no, 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 there must be a subscription. It's like, there's nothing. I just taught you how to do this on stage. Just use it, man. You never have to talk to me again. So the concept was to figure out the best cities in America to invest in at this specific time. So that had nothing to do with syndication. Therefore, I became obsessed with, I must not use paid data. So if you type in Neil space Bawa space Udemy, U-D-E-M-Y, you'll see 10,000 people taking a course. That course basically shows you how to rank every city in the US in order of in five different ways, and then roll it up and figure out the highest ranking for cities. And you notice that all of the data sources are free on the web. They're all free on the web. So real estate is amazingly lucky in that the stuff we need is available on the web when it comes to either city ranking or neighborhood ranking. All of it is free. Obviously, at a property level, that's when you need CoStar, right? Your app, it's really, really difficult to be a successful syndicator without paid data. What I'm telling you, though, is my brand isn't based on I'm the best syndicator in the US. My brand is based on I'm the best real estate data scientist in the US. And I give you data that you can use without ever giving me any money, right? So of the 58,000 highly engaged investors, only 800 have given me money. That's only 1.6%, right? Mm-hmm. The others are just simply getting data from me to buy real estate however they want, wherever they want. So I can't possibly use real estate tools like CoStar.
Interesting. Is there anything else though out there? Is there any other secret sauce on public?
I do like some that are cheap enough so that I talk about them. One tool that I feel that syndicators tend to ignore is Neighborhood Scout. Because while CoStar has great data from the perspective of the property and its competitors and cap rates and things like that that we all care about, Neighborhood Scout is much better at telling you the story of the neighborhood than CoStar does, right? And so what I find is that every single property, if you pull a CoStar report and pull a Neighborhood Scout report and create systems that actually look at data on both sides, you'll catch a bunch of things that most people don't. And Neighborhood Scout is, it's really, really cheap compared to CoStar. I mean, it's a hundredth of the cost.
Interesting. Well, what I was really excited about was to have this conversation. I thought the last hour was going to be just some basic stuff, but I mean, there's so much here and I'm enjoying it so much. But the thing that really caught my attention when I first started doing some research on you is this real estate top 10 disruptive trends. I think there's, when I first read it, there was some, I kind of get that. And there were some others that I'm not sure I get it. So maybe we just walk through them real quick.
Sure.
I mean, I have them in front of me. So if you need some, but I think you probably know them, but what are the top 10 disruptive trends? But before we say what they are, why did you feel the need to come up with 10? Are there 50 that you really wanted? Were there really five, but you thought 10 was a better list? Why is it 10?
Terrible answer. 10 just sounded cool, right? Okay. No other reason. Right. We were ranking about 50 of them. And actually, just so you know, the list that is in front of you is out of date because, our rankings change all of the time, right? So I'm just going to name the ones that right now I'm excited about. It doesn't really matter. As you said, 10 is just a number. It doesn't mean anything. I'll give you the ones that I think are truly beneficial. Only some of them apply to syndicators. Some of them, basically, I think anyone listening to benefits from, right? So the first one, and I'll go through it the quickest, is simply COVID massively accelerated the move away from expensive Democrat tax states to cheaper Republican states that are, lower in taxation, lower in property taxes. We've been tracking this since 2016. We use a report called the annual U-Haul report. So each year in January, U-Haul comes out with a report that shows you how many people move from which city to what city. They use city pairs. They use state pairs. So they say things like 293,000 people went to Texas from California and only 142,000 went from Texas to California, right? So the both direction. So we study that report. We actually manually have a virtual assistant type it into Excel, and then we massage the data so that we can kind of see which states and cities are the biggest winners. That was massively accelerated by COVID because of remote work. most people think that, you know, most people have gone back, right? So let me give you an example. Like Austin, for example, was always the lowest in terms of remote work through the pandemic. So when we drank the cities that had the highest number of people working remotely and the lowest, San Jose, California had the most number of people working remotely in the pandemic, and Austin, Texas had the lowest number of people working remotely. Basically because the culture there was, you know, asshole, just show up for work and then damn it. You know, if you get sick, you get sick, but otherwise you're showing up for work. That's their culture there, right? In Austin. And I wouldn't think that Austin was that kind of culture, but it is. Data is the data. But when I look at a company that does key swipes for offices, this is a company that sells key swiping software for offices, only 43% of the people that were going to the office pre-COVID are back in San Jose. And in Austin, it's only 63%. So today, there's nobody that can talk about COVID. I mean, I didn't wear a mask on a plane last week. Yeah. What COVID, right? So only 63% are back. These are huge numbers. In real estate, you can generate massive profits when a trend changes by 10%. 10% of anything is enough to create massive profits. This is a one-time opportunity where a trend that affects 330 million people is in the double digits.
Yeah.
You're not going to find one like this for the next 10 or 20 years. So stop obsessing about 10. Just focus on this one. That every quaternary markets, and this is a term I've invented because I've never found a term. You know, there's primary markets like Los Angeles or New York, and there's secondary markets. Arguably, Phoenix could be considered a secondary. I think it's a little bit too big, you know, but Austin is a good secondary market. You know, Houston could be a secondary market. And then there's tertiary markets, you know, Salt Lake City, right? What is happening is that our data shows us that today the markets smaller than Salt Lake City are producing intense amounts of profit. It's a one-time spurt. It'll never happen again. Once it's done, right? So we are finding that Salt Lake City is not interesting to us, even though it's a tertiary market. You know what's interesting? Woods Cross, 45 miles away from Salt Lake City. Logan, Utah, 95 miles away from Salt Lake City. Or Ogden, which is, you know, about 80 miles away, right? Idaho Falls, it's 150 miles away from either Boise or Salt Lake City. Those cities are seeing astonishing returns. They are definitely one time. They are definitely things that will stop because nothing can continue growing at these astonishing numbers forever. And we haven't seen the impact on the interest rates yet because the rents are rising at these cities twice or three times faster. But cap rates haven't caught up yet. They will. They haven't caught up yet. So you still have more room when you're buying stuff there. So to me, that is the first trend. There's 1,000 cities in the U.S. that you can track today that are seeing astonishing growth because there is a one-time move of people from dense cities to less dense cities. That, I think, in itself is massive.
I'll give you two data points on that I back that up and things that we've seen. Number one, one of my dear friends is a major, major airport parking operator. And he was saying to me that the trend is, it is screaming out that pre-COVID parking lots at airports filled up from noon on Friday and then emptied out from noon on Sunday back. Now it is absolutely clear parking lots are filling up on noon on Thursday and emptying out about noon on Monday. Meaning that people are using two travel days as work days and that the people coming in the office Monday to Friday is gone out the window. We're seeing in our Class A office buildings that since California got rid of the mask mandate, we are at 62-65% occupancy 3 days a week, right? Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So that has become the new normal. The other point that I thought was interesting, I went to Duke University and I have a lot of friends in North Carolina. I have a friend who's a home builder near Wilmington, North Carolina.
Yeah, and Durham, by the way.
Okay. I love Durham there a lot. But he was telling me in Wilmington, the amount of people who have moved there and who are full-time employed in other states has gone something like 25% in 1 year. So these are people who are
right. That's nuts. That's you have to imagine the amount of profits to be made when a 25% swing happens in a country that doesn't even grow at 1% a year.
That's exactly right.
U.S. population growth is 0.7%.
Now, the question I had for him is, so are they moving to Wilmington because there's job growth there? We haven't really had, outside of the construction issue, it's not job growth there. It's that there are significant, and there's industries that have significantly moved away from full-time in the office. Now, I think there's a lot of debate about that, and we'll save it for another time, about what that means for the role of office and whether it can truly work that way with a distributed workforce. I think there are a lot of positives to it. But if you just look at what, to circle it back to this COVID, if I'm being extraordinarily honest with myself, you know, I wasn't in the office any more than 60% of the time before COVID because I was traveling for work, or
right.
I was just really, our company got rid of paper in 2010, you know, 2011, we did a lot of things that took away what would have brought you to an office. So that fundamental change, I agree with you, it's been accelerated. As I say all the time, I think what COVID-19 did was democratize the hierarchy in a job, in a company. Because it now did. It's not just the senior execs who can be in the office 60% of the time. It's more and more. So I agree with you. I think, and that change has also had a fundamental impact on how you build apartments and how you build new homes, because now people need a place to work within a home or in an apartment. And so there's some really, I mean, I know your second one, which is one it was close to my heart, is the healthy home design.
Yep.
And I was just touching on that. And so you start to look at what you're going to check. I'll just say, for our future office investment, one of the things, even though we've taken 1920 buildings and made them as though they're brand new with the infrastructure and all, clearly that if you're going to own an office building, it's got to be a newer office building, and it's got to have every bell and whistle around ESG. So I think that's one of your trends, both in the home and the office. But we hit COVID and hybrid work. Is there another one you want to talk about that you think is really significant?
Yeah, because I think the first one applies to everyone listening to this podcast. I think the second one applies to syndicators. So I feel like that's a good balance to have, right? Because you have a lot of people listening to you. You're an experienced, well-known syndicator. So there's people listening to you that are interested in syndication. I can tell you this. In the next 3 years, all of you, everyone that is looking to syndicate, will have to tokenize your assets. If you do not tokenize, you will be at an enormous, massive disadvantage. And you simply will have no choice. It's just like, you know, people that use Juniper Square or IDR or the software. Today, you can't really conceive of running a scaled business without having an investor management software. It's a necessary evil, right? Tokenization is a necessary evil that has a great business advantage as well. So there's advantages there beyond the necessary evil part, but there's no getting away from the necessary evil. Okay. So I am one of those people that really knows and understands tokenization, because I come from a world where I'm an investor, not just in Bitcoin and Ethereum, but I'm an investor in the blockchain infrastructure, which is much more powerful than Bitcoin. I mean, I don't particularly invest in Bitcoin simply because it's a store of value, where blockchain is a store of systems and processes and, you know, a democratization of finance, right? It's much more powerful than simply people speculating on the value of Bitcoin. So I'm very interested in that. And I know that that thing is going to disrupt the way that syndicators work, and it's both good and bad. So on the good side, 3 years from now, you cannot possibly be buying a value-add property and not be tokenizing it for your investors, because that's what gives them liquidity. And you might say, how can one investor, one guy, how can one person create liquidity? Sure, we have a $500 million portfolio. The answer is you won't. Groups of syndicators will get together. And I'll tell you, this is how it'll start. The largest airlines in the world are American Airlines, like United and American, right? But what these people realized is that they couldn't possibly create the scale that they wanted on their own. So American Airlines created the three large alliances in the world. So there's, you know, Star, there's Oneworld, and SkyTeam, each of them led by one legacy American airline, right? So, and by doing so, by creating these alliances, they completely changed the airline industry and the way that it functions. Now, very often, I fly on a plane that just says Star Alliance. It doesn't have an airline name on it, because it's owned by an alliance that basically gives benefits to all of its customers. What will end up happening is that syndicators will join alliances to create a singular token, and they'll call it real coin or something like that. And when they do that, that token itself will have value, because isn't that what Bitcoin does? Isn't the value of Bitcoin simply in the fact that people believe it has value? Because otherwise, why would one Bitcoin be $39,000? It would be worth 39 cents. People believe it has value. What if syndicator groups got together in alliances? By the way, I'm going to form the first one. Got together, because I know everyone in the industry, and everyone in the industry knows me. So we're going to form an alliance of value-add coins. And when we do, that coin will become liquid, not Christopher's property, not Neil's properties. We're not big enough. But what if there were 100 syndicators using a single coin? And the moment you do that, nobody wants to invest with anybody that's not in that alliance.
Interesting.
Because now it's truly liquid, and there's software coming. Guess what I'm investing in these days? Software that creates liquidity for real estate.
Yeah.
Software that creates liquidity for real estate syndication. This is all coming. It's crazy, right? I mean, and people are like, oh, yeah, it's not going to happen for us. Come on. The Jobs Act already completely changed the real estate industry. We only exist today because of the Jobs Act. And how quickly did it happen? Look at where we are today compared to 2014. Only 8 years have passed. And one could even argue that it was completely baked by 2018. Since then, the number of syndicators has grown. But the, whoops.
I see you.
Oh, sorry.
That you're, yeah.
The number of syndicators has grown, but I don't think since 2018, anything fundamentally has changed about the way we do syndications. So between 2014 and 2018, the syndication industry was completely baked. Right? It got completely baked in 4 years. Tokenization, when it happens, will completely rebake the industry. And it's happening now. There's properties of my friends have been tokenized in the last 30 days, right? So
yeah.
In Texas. So this is massive. It's both very good news and very bad news. And luckily, it's very good news first.
Yeah. But there are issues with it. I mean, I know Lofty AI and a few others have had some issues in tokenization. I was very proud of myself that I got my .eth wallet, and I've owned my Algorand, and I own my Friends with Benefits and all that kind of stuff. But it's still so clunky and so hard, and there's still these fear factor whenever I am interacting with my wallet that somehow it's going to get hacked. Do you really think it's just a couple years away for an alliance token for syndicators to be out, or are there a few other steps before that can really happen?
I think that the software to make these things safer is on the way. So there are two different ways that that's happening. Every single software that you're used to, like Juniper Square, do you use Juniper Square?
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So imagine right now what Juniper Square is doing. They're hiring a team to build the Ethereum component. Bitcoin is not used for this purpose because it's not efficient. But Ethereum and Polygon is a layer 2 chain that is basically built on top of Ethereum. It's much cheaper to use Polygon. It's much faster. Right now, every one of your favorite investor management software is developing the back end so that you never have to go out and do any of those things.
Okay.
Because, right, so there's already 3 million accredited investors inside about a dozen software. And all of those are developing the tokenization interface to be seamless. So your investors are always doing what they're doing, and you're doing what you're always doing. And the tokenization is happening in the background.
Yeah.
And well, I think that's going to take about 3 years to get that right. And there's going to be some hacking, you know, that's going on. Here's the other thing. If your MetaMask wallet gets hacked and you had $1 million of Bitcoin, now you're $1 million poorer, correct? Because it's gone. There's no way to get it back. However, the kind of tokenization that real estate syndicators are doing today, we still have the right to reissue tokens. So if the hack occurs, it's a pain in the ass, it's stress, but we're going to reissue the tokens once we've made sure that the investor actually got hacked. So the beauty of what we are doing is that we are not doing ICO or initial coin offering. That's dangerous. We are doing STO, securitized token offering, where the securitizer still has control.
Yeah.
Right? And that reduces the offering. That reduces the risk tremendously.
When do you think states will catch up? Because I know that Lofty AI, which is really an interesting thing to watch, really can't work in California at this point.
The answer is, I mean, Lofty is a wonderful example. I know the folks personally. I've advised them. I've been in their offices. And I've advised them against doing what they're doing now, which is, single family tokenization. I've said, look, you built a wonderful platform. Why don't you tokenize a $50 million property and do it right? Right. But they're obsessed with this idea of, every investor in the planet and $50. I think it's a terrible, terrible business model, even if it was legally in the right, which, as we both know, it's very much in the gray. Right.
Yeah.
So they're doing stuff that is problematic. Here's the good news, though. You know why I love Lofty and why Christopher should love Lofty? It's the gray people that force the SEC to create rules. And the first one, they just kill them. The second one, they beat them down with $250,000 fine. The third one gets a $50,000 fine. By the fourth time, they're like, chuck it, man. They're gonna break the law anyway. Might as well write the rules.
Yeah.
Rules in the US are written when 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 companies go out of business. So this is, and I'm not saying Lofty will be that one, but I'm saying they've got a nice, little bullseye painted on their back, right? So the beautiful thing is rules get written this way. Why do you think that accredited investor rules exist in the US today? Because back in the 80s, a bunch of people screwed over non-accredited investors, and then the SEC had to step in and create rules. Same thing's going to happen on tokenization in the next 3 years. Until 3 months ago, no one was tokenizing, so why create rules? But do you know that currently tokenization for multifamily properties is on a 1,000% exponential curve? So in 2 years, there will be tens of thousands of properties. What choice does the SEC have? They will have to create rules.
Yeah, interesting. Neil, I mean, I feel like we could go for 4 hours. I think probably the best thing
This is probably the longest podcast you've ever had.
That's true. Well, and the most interesting. I know my audience is going to love it. How can they find you? What would be the best? Where can I point them to?
I picked my own name. My name is Navraj, N-A-V-R-A-J, Bawa. That's an Indian name, right? And so when I picked my name, I said, I want to be the easiest person in the world to find. So when I picked Neil, the problem was there were more than one Neils with an American spelling. So I used the Irish spelling. As it happens, I'm the only Neil Bawa on the World Wide Web, as long as you use N-E-A-L. So the best way to find me is just simply type my first and last name and hit enter. You'll see a bunch of podcasts. Usually when I do podcasts, I have a specific topic. You're the exception because you basically did 4 different podcasts with me in the last 90 minutes. But there's like Neil Bawa Virtual Assistant, Neil Bawa Outsourcing, Neil Bawa Business Process Automation, or Neil Bawa Best Cities or Location Magic.
Yeah.
So if you just type in a word after my name, then you'll get a bunch of content that's specific to that idea.
That is terrific. Well, I have to have you back on. We've got at least 8 trends we missed. And I really am engaged on so many of the things that you said. So I want to be able to listen to this and go back. But Neil, thank you for being on The Real Market. This has been a terrific podcast.
Thank you, Christopher. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And please don't forget to follow us. We'd really appreciate it if you subscribe to the podcast. You can do that on Apple iTunes or any of the other podcasting services. It's The Real Market with Chris Rising. And follow us on Twitter at Chris Rising or at Rising RP. And please follow our blog, chrisrising.com or risingrp.com. Thanks so much.
This episode of The Real Market is brought to you by Rising Investor Platform. The platform provides accredited investors with exclusive real estate investment opportunities on a deal-by-deal basis across various asset classes, including office, industrial, hospitality, multifamily, and data. The platform also provides an inside look at deals in our pipeline while giving investors the chance to indicate interest before it's too late. We recently funded our acquisition of 9320 Telstar, a mixed-use office industrial property in El Monte, California, using our investor platform. To learn more about how accredited investors can join the Rising Investor Platform, please visit risinginvestorplatform.com.